Hello, I'm Barry Daniel, and this is the podcast of the Middle Way Society. Our aim is to encourage a universal approach to living a more integrated, ethical life, avoiding dogma or any appeal to authority. We are joined today by the author and essayist Chuck Klosterman, who has written books and essays focused on American popular culture. He's been a columnist for Esquire and ESPN.com and wrote the Ethicist column for the New York Times magazine. Chuck is the author of 8 books, including 2 novels and the essay collection Sex, Drugs and Cocoa Puffs, a Low Culture Manifesto. He talks to us today about his latest book, But What If We're Wrong? Thinking about the present as if it were the past, as well as other aspects of having a skeptical mindset. Hello, Chuck. Welcome to the Middle Way Society podcast.
Hey, it's great to be on.
Okay, well, I really enjoyed your book, Chuck. I thought it was such a great idea. What prompted you to write it?
Well, you know, I think it's often like a multi-level decision when you write a book. Like, in a sense, I suppose I had always felt, or I have always maybe unconsciously been aware of this idea that the way we perceive reality is somehow false or illusionary. So even when I was 8 years old, I think I probably thought to myself, there's something about the way we kind of live in this universe and the way we perceive it that's just off. Of course, I wouldn't have had the language to describe it as an 8-year-old, but I've always kind of felt that way. Then in another level, I think that maybe a lot of my writing, the last few books I've done, have sort of dealt with this central question, this idea of that our accepted beliefs inherently flawed, and are we kind of working through problems as if we understand things that are just sort of constructions. But then the most specific level is that, you know, I was watching a science series called Cosmos, and the most interesting part to me when I was watching this series was any time they would talk about something that had happened in the distant past where some scientist or just some observer, maybe sometimes even an explorer, would come up with a realization that contradicted what we had always believed in the past. And within one generation of that person's life, it seemed as if those ideas had become universal, almost as if we had always thought this way. And I thought to myself, well, that must be happening now. I mean, we're just not aware of it. It's not visible because we're inside of the system itself, but that must be going on. And while I was watching this, I was reading about Moby Dick. And I always note that I was not actually reading Moby Dick. I was reading about it and about the life of Herman Melville and how he had believed that when he was writing Moby Dick, that this was his, you know, greatest work, that this was his kind of his master opus. And then it came out and it got mixed reviews, didn't sell that well. Kind of ruined his life, and he died, kind of perhaps thinking that Moby Dick had been, in truth, his ultimate failure. But then after World War I, the book was sort of reinterpreted and reevaluated. And it became not just a great novel, but almost the great novel, the template for what writing, you know, the great American novel or whatever is supposed to be. Now, obviously, the idea of science and stuff are objective truths. And books are subjective, but they're both kind of tied into the same kind of bedrock principle, which is that the history of ideas is the history of people being wrong. So I started thinking about life now under kind of like I'm almost just accepting reflexively the idea that we are wrong about central things. And what does that mean? And, you know, that's kind of the core problem.
Yeah. Okay. So how did you structure the book?
Well, I structured the book kind of just going through a lot of the different topics that I often write about. I in all my books, I typically discuss rock music. I write about sports a lot, television and film. In this book, I also kind of talk about politics. I talk about science. It's almost as though I'm asking the same question over and over again, but in different ways. It sort of might appear like it's a collection of essays, but it's really not, because I would like to think that each topic sort of builds on the conclusion from the previous section. But it's very wide ranging, and it's not like what often happens when you do something like this, because I mean, fundamentally a generalist, is that a scientist will read the book and they will be like, well, I kind of liked all of this, but I have issues with the science chapter. Or a rock critic will read it and they'll be like, this book was great, but I don't believe what you were writing about music. It seems as though that people tend to disagree with whatever idea they feel that they understand the best, which in some ways is the problem.
Yeah.
It's almost as if the more we learn and integrate ideas with ourselves, the more that we look at ourselves as somebody who really understands something, the less willing we are to break away from the galvanized ideas, because those ideas and sort of the superstructure of the understanding of the topic is part of our own identity.
Yeah. And in many ways, the sort of basic premise of the book is that it's very difficult to understand what's happening today until it's become tomorrow. But you also, what you find really surprising is how often that understanding is ignored. What's going on there?
Well, you know, okay, so the idea of the book is that if you really boil it down to its simplest, most reduced terms, it's that things that we believe now might be proven incorrect. And if you go up to a person on the street and you say to them, hey, you know, do you believe that there are things that we accept now that later on in 300 years will seem absurd? Their response will be, well, of course, that's just the history of the world. They'll be completely unsurprised by that. But then you start giving them specific examples. You start asking them questions like, well, okay, I mean, this is an American example, but like if you went to someone on the streets of the United States and said, you know, do you think that the way we gauge presidents in 500 years will be different, and a president who we currently think that might be great will be perceived negatively? They'll be like, oh yeah, I could see that happening. We're constantly reshuffling this. But then you say, well, okay, it's going to be Abraham Lincoln. Then they just completely freak out. It's almost as though in the abstract, everyone can accept that we're wrong, but nobody wants to be wrong about specific ideas, because abstractions are just, they seem theoretical to people. They just seem like, oh, sure. You know, it's like, this is just kind of like, you know, the pattern of ideology or whatever. But these things that I believe personally, these specific things, they're unchangeable.
So if that's a bias we all have, Chuck, what strategies did you use in the book to avoid those biases in yourself?
That's a good question, I guess, because I'm sure they're still in there to some degree. Like in the U.S. now, there's been a shift in journalism. There's no belief in the United States that you should be as transparent as possible, and that since objectivity is impossible because we're not robots, we should just sort of give up on the idea. But that really runs counter to the way to my thinking when I got into this and how I still feel. My belief is always the thing you're supposed to do is be hyper aware of your biases. And then be conscious of that as you work. So whenever I wrote about anything, about any topic, I started with the premise that here is what I believe. But my faith in my wrongness is actually greater than my faith in any idea. So it wasn't that I don't feel like it's that difficult to sort of step out of yourself and say like, well, okay, how can I keep my personal ideas from sort of coloring the work? I'm still the person writing it. I want the writing to be kind of lively and conversational. So, of course, there's part of me in the book. But this is just sort of the pitfalls of thinking about history or thinking about futurism. I mean, it's the inherent risk that your own ideas are going to color your perception of what are supposed to be neutral ideas.
And is that Klosterman's razor?
Well, yeah, I mean, the thing that was a little kind of like a little joke I made in the book, but not totally a joke. I mean, okay, there's Occam's razor, right? There's this idea that when you're looking at a situation, the potential answer with the least number of variables is probably the correct response. So if you talk to a lawyer or a policeman and they're trying to deal with some situation and it's unknown, it's mysterious, they will say, well, we'll use Occam's razor. Well, whatever is the simplest conclusion is the most probable. So I kind of thought of kind of a corollary to that, which is that when I'm thinking about some distant future, I am going to assume that whatever seems like the most logical conclusion is reflexively wrong, because we just don't live in a rational world. I mean, when I write about the future of rock music, for example, I have this whole section about this idea that maybe in 300 years, rock music has become just a totally academic pursuit, in the same way so many other music from the distant past has become this thing only experts know about. And inevitably, the entire genre gets boiled down to one artist, and that artist becomes interchangeable with the idiom itself. Now, let's say this happens with rock music. The logical answer to this would be the Beatles.
Yeah.
Like in a rational world, the Beatles would be the band that becomes sort of the interchangeable template for what rock music was. But we don't live in a rational world. So then you got to go to this idea of like, okay, if the logical answer is not going to happen, what else could occur? Yeah.
So what degree does merit play a part in this, if any? We sort of want it to matter, don't we?
Well, we certainly would. I mean, that's – and it's depressing to even suggest that merit plays less a role in this. It doesn't play the primary role, because we would like to think great things are rewarded. But I think the main thing merit does is it gets people – gets different individuals involved in the conversation. You have to have enough merit to be in this sort of historical conversation. But once that conversation happens, the merit almost becomes like the secondary thing. I use sort of Shakespeare as an example. Everyone concedes that Shakespeare is the greatest playwright of all time, arguably the greatest writer of all time. Now, why is he the greatest playwright? Well, Shakespeare's plays are the most Shakespearean. Like, it's a tautological thing. We've made the decision that this is what's great. So, of course, his ability to be himself proves that greatness. Yeah. So, I mean, so now if someone else had been selected, if one of his peers had been selected, and that could have happened, had the world worked differently, had something in their life sort of changed the way they were remembered, well, then the qualities of that individual's work would be the tautology that proves that it's great, you know?
Yeah, okay. Well, let's move on to science now, Chuck, and paradigm shifts, which you talked about a bit in the book. What are they, and who was it who first coined the term? What did he mean by it?
Yeah, well, it's a guy named Thomas Kuhn came up with this idea of that science being like, I mean, this is troubling to scientists, but maybe a little less clinical and a little less objective than we think. Basically, Kuhn would say that, everyone believes something for a long period of time, the paradigm shifts, and then all the scientists kind of work within that realm, kind of detailing and kind of like focusing the idea of this central idea, and then inevitably that idea shifts and everyone kind of, you know, recalibrates how they work. Now, his big thing is the Copernican Revolution. Like, that's his primary example. What a lot of scientists now, like some of the scientists I interviewed, would say is that's actually the last time that has happened. That since the 1600s, which was when also, you know, we invented the microscope and the telescope, and Newton sort of founded the bedrock ideas about gravity, and the scientific method became the way science works. And instead of being tied into philosophy, science became tied in with math. That since then, there will not be another shift. I don't know. I guess that's I'm not a scientist. That could be true. Although, you know, every generation kind of thinks this. I'm sure people in the 1500s did not expect like, oh, well, there'll be this big shift in the way we all think. It's like everyone thinks they're right until they're not. Now, it kind of seems like something Yoda would say, and it's not exactly practical, but it's kind of central to this argument. It's very difficult for people, because there's some – it does seem, you know, in some ways like – a counterproductive argument. Like, what value is there in saying, well, what we think now will not be thought of by people who have yet to be born, that we'll never experience? It almost seems impractical. But this book, like I say, is not an attempt to sort of like it's not to tell people how to live. It's just sort of a new way how to think.
Well, that got me thinking a little bit, because especially about objectivity, which you talk about
on several occasions in the book, and in particular the work of Thomas Nagel. Do you think our view of objectivity could potentially change in the future to come in line with Nagel's suggestion that rather than objectivity be some unrealistic God's eye view of things, we could use it incrementally, and it's something that people have rather than theories or propositions have? This would arguably be very much in line with the latest findings in neuroscience and psychology that challenge dichotomies such as objectivity, subjectivity, reason, emotion, facts and values, etc. For example, you also talk about the shift in the book from logical intelligence to emotional intelligence, and that perhaps in 100 years' time, qualitative intelligence might be prioritized over quantitative aptitude.
Well, I mean, the first point you're making is, I think the central question here is, when thinking about objectivity, is there such a thing as, for lack of a better term, close enough? Like the objectivity someone's using is close enough, because I think there's a lot of absolutists in this who would argue that if a 100% total objectivity is impossible, we shouldn't be trying at all, because even if you're off by just a little bit, if the person is just slightly biased who's sort of delivering this information, that's going to inform this whole rippling effect of decisions. It's better off if they just don't try at all. Now, like I say, I don't agree with this. I think this idea of that if individuals attempt to be as objective as possible, if there's enough sort of sources, you know, doing the same kind of work, it will get pretty close to, you know, maybe not a perfect middle, but as I say, close enough. I mean, this idea of emotional intelligence and intellectual intelligence, that's in reference to something where, you know, even as recently as the 1980s, the idea of emotional intelligence was kind of scoffed at as something that's like you would see like in a women's magazine or something. Like it was just like this idea of a construction of a different kind of, it had nothing to do with real intelligence. Well, that has changed. Now I think people say, you know, if you were applying for a job, the guy doing the interview might say, well, you know, as far as I'm concerned, emotional intelligence is as important as scholastic intelligence. Well, let's say this keeps going. Let's say that in 50 or 100 years, emotional intelligence is actually perceived as much more important than kind of conventional academic scholastic intelligence. Well, that kind of creates a strange problem, because at the same time, there is a growing belief in the zoological community that animals have much higher emotional intelligence than humans, you know, at least other mammals, an ape or dog or whatever. Well, that would put us in this weird position where we'd be essentially saying we concede emotional intelligence is the most important quality, yet we kind of govern and dominate all these creatures that we concede now are more intelligent to us. And it's not like we'd switch. It's not like we'd suddenly go like, you know, let's elect cats to government. Right. It would say, you know, the world would stay as it is. But it would be a very uncomfortable dichotomy where we would be ruling creatures that we have concluded are more intelligent than us.
Just sticking with this paradigm shift for one more question. It has been argued at times that we're perhaps even now entering a third phase of human thought. For example, in the first medieval phase, scientific objectivity was limited by its sort of subjection to moral metaphysics. In the second modern phase, you know, with the Enlightenment, etc., conclusions were drawn by relating observation to theory, and ethics in many ways was made irrelevant. You know, this again, this objectivity, God's eye view type of things. But in a third phase of human thought, which may possibly be happening, science and ethics could be seen as unified, with objective judgment in each involving a process of balancing out models, with the chances of these models being wrong. And your book, in many ways, it could be part of that paradigmatic process in a sense.
I guess. I mean, it's a good but very complicated question. What I thought you were going to ask is sort of about the possibility of like moving in toward like a synchronicity where basically our minds and the internet are connected, and there would be this, you know, all the knowledge of the world we would have instant access to all the time. So then that would sort of alter what the meaning of being an intelligent, creative person is. Yeah. Like if there was nothing left to learn and we could live essentially forever in a electronic world, that would change a lot of things about ethics. I mean, what you're arguing, I guess, I don't know. I mean, that's how do you see my book as an extension of that? I mean, it might be, but I don't.
I suppose it's back to Klosterman's razor in many ways. It's this recognition that a lot of we hold to be true and objective is subject to fallibility, and that is a healthy, arguably way, yeah. healthier way of looking at things. And also this idea that reason and emotion, etc., they're inextricably linked. This idea that we're just rational beings has been debunked in many ways.
Yeah, well, okay, I guess I have two responses to this. I'll see if I don't know if either one really answers it. But, you know, interestingly, when this book came out, initially I was often interviewed by people from the business community, like Business Insider and all these publications dealing with business, who would ask me things like, well, how can this philosophy be applied to the world of business? The idea that and what I told them is that, you know, this book is thinking about ideas in 100, 300 or 1,000 years. If you're starting a business, you can't think in those terms. You can't think to yourself, you know, if I'm selling, you know, open a pancake house and be like, will these pancakes still be enjoyed in 1,000 years? It's not going to help a lot. Like there's a certain kind of lack of utility in this, because I'm like thinking way down the line. So, you know, it's in a day-to-day way, I don't know what this, if this sort of kind of, I guess, for lack of a better term, philosophical thinking, like what is the utility? I mean, okay, is there a possibility that I'm on the third floor of my apartment? Is there a possibility that in the lobby of my apartment, there's a whole bunch of tigers? Yeah. I suppose that there is a minuscule chance of that. Do I need to factor that in when I go downstairs? You can't live that way. Like this is, and maybe to some people this sort of invalidates a lot of it. It's like, I mean, this book is a thought experiment. It's a way we can't go through life thinking that everything we believe is wrong, but I can. I'm in the luxury of having this position. So I can write this book, and for like 288 pages, other people can sort of have this same experience.
Okay, well, I suppose I try to think and maybe have a similar sensibility to you like that, but it's also something, this sense of provisionality, if you want, for want of a better word. You know, I know if I'm looking at my hand now, that 99.99% I'm actually looking at my hand, but just maintaining that bit of provisionality that I could be dreaming, it could possibly be a simulation, not that I realistic believe it, just holding that the idea of holding your beliefs lightly and having that sort of sensibility of skepticism or openness to fallibility, when better evidence comes along, you're not so sort of stuck, you know, fixated on being right, in a sense.
Yeah, well, I mean, what you're saying now, I think is a fundamentally just like, that's a great kind of perception. I mean, why is that? What has happened, I wonder sometimes. Maybe I feel like this has happened in my own lifetime. Maybe it's been happening since the beginning of time incrementally. But how is it that expressing certitude somehow scans to a certain kind of person as intelligence? Like I think the internet maybe has fed into this in a way that there's so many ideas being expressed that the only way to get attention now is to be on the absolute poles of whatever the argument is. And the people on the absolute poles are the most certain of their correctness.
Yeah.
And I mean, that to me, I don't know if that's necessarily dangerous, but it's absolutely annoying, and it's a terrible way to sort of run the discourse. Yeah. I mean, I am of the view that an intelligent person sort of perceives that what they believe could be flawed, and that confidence unless you believe that somehow you were talking about, you know, are we really rational? Well, we're more rational than the other animals, it seems, but we're not completely rational. There are real limits to sort of what we can understand. And even like I kind of write in there about just the idea of infinity. Like we all can describe what infinity is, if it was on a multiple choice test with four descriptions of infinity, most people would be able to answer that question. And yet, can we actually comprehend what infinity means and what it constitutes? I don't know. It might be beyond us. I just think there are lots of things that are beyond us. You mentioned the idea of living in a simulation. Now, do I believe we are living in a simulation? Well, I don't. But part of that is based on the fact that there's something about this experience that just seems too real to me, like the sense of aliveness I can't get my mind around. But of course, that makes no sense. If this was the high end simulation that like Bostrom and all these people talk about, of course, that would be built in to the creation of my quote unquote character. Of course, that character would have a limit to what they could, what am I comparing this realness to? Well, nothing. I've only had one experience. So do I think it's possible that we're in a simulation? Absolutely. I mean, not enough for me to change the way I live, but in a conversation about it, it makes a lot of sense to me. Like there are many problems in life that if you concede that we were a simulation, those problems disappear and suddenly have answers.
Yeah. Just going back to your question for a couple of minutes ago, why is it that people who are prized in many ways, who are offering certainty. Could it be because we sort of have an itch for certainty? And in some ways, it's quite adaptive that maybe when we're out there on the savannah, you needed someone who could give you a quick answer. In some ways, we gravitate to our politicians that say, this is the way it's going to be. And I think in the States as well as the UK, it's really looked down upon if a politician changes their mind, as if that is a bad thing.
Well, I know that's flip-flopping is what they always call it here, as if it would somehow be preferable that people are completely inflexible and whatever ideas they had when they were 23 years old would be the ideas they exist forever. That would be, we would never apply that to any other person. You would never say that, I had bad parents because over 30 years I saw their positions and their opinions change. You would never say that. That's just crazy. I mean, that whole savannah idea you talk about, I always think that's probably an underrated aspect to this. I mean, one thing that I am here again, it's weird to be talking about this. Like I was going to say, I feel certain about this. I feel is the key. I'm not certain, but is that technology has evolved so much faster than I think the human biological ability to change, that a lot of the things about life that seem confusing or alienating is really the collision of these things that were built into us for thousands of years dealing with technology that has existed for 40 years.
Exactly.
An example, I don't talk about this in the book, but I have in other books, and I'm not the first person who thinks of this, but I just think it's absolutely true. Like many people kind of feel vaguely alienated with technology, particularly the internet and these things. They don't, Tom York from Radiohead or whatever, they express this kind of vague alienation that many people can relate to, even though they love technology and they would hate the idea of losing it. Well, for however long you want to say mankind has existed, and this is an arguable thing, 25,000 years, 12,000 years, 80,000 years, wherever you kind of say, okay, these people in Africa, they were the first people, whatever, however long you want to say, let's use 25,000 years. Okay, so for 24,990 years roughly, if someone saw a lion moving in front of them, a lion was there. Okay, that's built into sort of our optic understanding of the world for thousands of years. That if you see something happening, that is what's happening. But starting with film, really, in the beginning of the 20th century, like the Great Train Robbery, whatever, I think came out in 1909. They always talk about that when the Great Train Robbery was first shown, there's footage of a guy shooting a gun at the camera. And supposedly, and this maybe didn't happen, but maybe it did, people in the audience ducked down because they actually thought someone's shooting a gun at me. Well, now, of course, we all know that images we see that are moving in front of us very often aren't real. Okay, it's not surprising at all to see footage of lions that we know are thousands of miles away, or that we look at someone's Facebook profile and we know, well, that's not really them. That's them constructing what they are like, and all of these things. We hear music and we know that music is not being played in front of us. It's being played in a studio 50 years ago or whatever. Well, we can intellectualize that and rationally understand it, but can our subconscious deal with it? And is that maybe what this alienation with technology comes from? Our body actually telling us, like, we're on Skype right now doing this interview, and I'm looking at you, and I know that you're, you know, across the ocean or whatever, and that this is but is part of me confused that this is happening? And I'm constantly trying to intellectually, in the subterranean part of my mind, reconcile that I'm not actually talking to you, you know? And it's just I think this is something that because we can sort of, you know, have a cogent conversation about it, it's like, oh, that's like what stoners talk about, like, but I think it's a real thing. I mean, it's just that there's no way that the human body can keep up with the rate of change that's happening in technology. I just don't see it. Yeah.
No, I definitely see something in that. Yeah. What's your greatest hope for the book, Chuck?
Well, you know, this is my honest answer. I just want people to enjoy the experience of reading it. And maybe, you know, if they take anything away from it, I would like them to think like, well, you know, okay, people will ask me, because I think this happens anytime you write about a book that involves the future. You know, is this book optimistic or pessimistic? Like, is it optimistic to think, oh, you know, the way we think of the world now is it could be totally wrong. And isn't it kind of wonderful and amazing that this is that the world can always surprise us? Or is it pessimistic? Does it suggest that the way we think of the world is a waste of time? We almost should give up. I mean, I kind of see the future as neutral, that the future is going to change. It's going to be different. But it's not going to really be better or worse than the way life is now. It'll seem worse to people who live during the whole period because, you know, whatever you're used to changes. Like, using music as an example, it's like, okay, so I grew up with cassettes and I had a limited number of cassettes and I had to, you know, I loved music, but all I could do was like afford a handful of cassettes that I just had to play over and over again. Now, a kid like me now would have thousands and thousands and thousands of songs that they could have free access to. And for the most part, they wouldn't investigate any of them that deeply, but they would have unlimited choice. Now, that kid would look at my life and seem like I'm in a prison. I look at that kid's life and I think like they're missing out something enriching about music.
Yeah.
But the fact of the matter is, I don't think either of those situations is better or worse. Yeah. And that's kind of the truth about the future. It's like it's not going to be better or worse. It's only going to be different. So it's going to seem worse if you were comfortable with the way things were. Although, you know, some changes, you know, there was a movie that came out, got no attention in the United States, a very small documentary called The Century of Self, I think it was called. And it was about people who had been born just prior to 1900 and lived beyond 2000. So it was like 103-year-old people talking about their life, you know. You know, they almost universally said, like, life now is better. And they would use examples like air conditioning. You know, they'd be like, I can't, you know, like, or like they were born before the Wright brothers flew a plane. And now, like, we went to space, like, they can't believe it. And they all shared a concern over how it must be to be a young person, like, dating and trying to, like, put a life together. So the things that made their life tangibly better, they're like, of course it's better. But this idea of how you're supposed to live, of course, seemed weird. I think that would be the same case. You know, it's only going to be amplified going forward. I mean, it's hard to imagine how a person born in 1999 who lives to, you know, 2101, how much different the world will be in that frame. I mean, it'll be exponentially greater than 1900 to 2000, which was exponentially greater than 1800 to 1900, although the exponential difference was not as much. Like, every century gets even greater, You know, the gap between the beginning and the end. I mean, you know, the difference between living in the year 1300, you know, in the year, you know, the 13th century, in the like that was different, but not the way it is now, you know.
Okay, my last question. The middle way, as we understand it in our society, is the idea that we make better judgments by avoiding fixed or dogmatic beliefs about things, whether those are positive or negative. That then throws us back on experience, so we're left in this sort of messy, uncertain middle. But it's arguably in the messy, uncertain middle that we can actually start to get to grips more adequately with the phenomena that we encounter, whatever they are. Now, how might that relate to what we've been talking about today?
What I would say is this, is that certainly you probably have a similar experience, in U.S. politics, the idea of pragmatism is viewed very pejoratively, almost as though it somehow hides some kind of evil. I just find that so insane. I mean, it's just that I feel as though that calling someone pragmatic is almost universally positive. I mean, yeah. It means looking at the world and you're saying like, well, these are the conditions. Under these conditions, what's the most reasonable conclusion that benefits the most number of people? So, I mean, I guess my natural inclination is toward that. I know, you know, like Bill Clinton, when he was president, at the end of his administration, he was regularly attacked by people on the left for that he just sort of became a pragmatist. But yeah. That just seems to be the way it's supposed to, like, that's what I want from, you want that from leadership. I mean, I will never relate to the idea of people romanticizing or glamorizing the idea of being an ideologue. That seems like the worst quality you can have about anyone who wants to be a kind of a conscientious person. Yeah. That somehow that an ideology you've adopted becomes transposable with your identity. Yeah. And that every problem you deal with has to be some sort of like when a question comes up about anything. But any kind, you know, whether about politics, but also about religion or whether about art or whatever the case may be, you've got to look at, you know, these ideologues will look at it and they'll be like, well, okay, how does that fit into my pre-existing belief about unrelated things? Here's a great example. Like, I'll just do this before we go. Like, okay, so Bob Dylan won the Nobel Prize for Literature. Yeah. Okay. And it's very kind of a controversial issue here, mostly because generally people have no idea who the winner is. But this is one time when everyone in the United States knows who won the Nobel Prize, which they can have an opinion on the guy, so it's more contentious. And there's a movement in the rock criticism community, the people who write about music, you know, like, you know, that there's this idea of called poptimism. And its adversary they see as rockism, okay? And poptimism is this idea that things like authenticity don't really matter and that it doesn't matter who wrote the song. Rock music should be a performative art, that people who are really into sort of the ideology of rock, the rockists, that they tend to be like kind of a white patriarchal group who are trying, you know. Okay, so these people now have this new problem. They have this issue that Dylan has won the Nobel Peace Prize or the Nobel Prize for Literature, not the Nobel Peace Prize. And their take seems to be like, okay, so what Dylan is rewarded for in music is kind of part of the rockist culture. So how can I find a problem with him winning a literary award? It's just the strangest thing. It's like I see them trying to shoehorn their opinion about Bob Dylan as an extension of literature into their pre-existing idea of Bob Dylan as a rock musician. I mean, that's like what an ideologue does. It's like that they've already made the decision about how they feel, and now they need to rationalize and intellectualize an explanation for why that's true. It's like it is the epitome of like an ideologue is someone who spends all their time reverse engineering. They start with the conclusion that fits with their side, and then they work backwards. And yeah. I guess maybe you'd ask me what people should take away from my book. I would say the opposite of that. Yeah. It's like the opposite of starting with a conclusion and then figuring out a way to describe why you feel that way.
Yeah. Well, I think they may could also do with a bit of a shave with your razor, your Klosterman's razor. I hope that idea takes on. Anyway, Chuck, just to the listeners out there, I'd highly recommend the book. I just thought it was full of insights and it had me laughing out loud at times as well. So thank you very much for talking to me today. It's been great.
Oh, yeah, my pleasure.
You can find out more about Middleway philosophy at www.middlewaysociety.org.